Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 16th day of October 2019. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk with Jackie Vakes about the commodity market. Scott Irwin from the U of I will be here to discuss the RVO, the RFS, and the ethanol announcement made yesterday and the impact it will have on the ethanol industry. And then we'll take up the weather forecast with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. In Chicago today, December corn finished a penny and a half lower at 391 and three quarters. The March at 403 and a half, three quarters lower. And May down three quarters at 409. July at 414 and three quarters, a half lower. November beans 6 cents lower at 928 on the day. The settlement price for the January at 942 and a quarter, down six and a quarter. March 4 3/4 lower. The May down 3 3/4. And next year's November 2 1/2 lower. It finished at 970. Bean oil up a penny. Bean meal down $3 even. Wheat futures July contract soft red 526 and a quarter, up 4 cents for the day. The hard red July at 455 and a half, 2 1/4 cents higher. Live cattle futures October contract at $112.35, up $1.35. Feeders in the October 22.5 cents higher. They finished at 145.22 and a half. In December, lean hogs on the day at $70.62 and a half, $1.50 lower. November crude oil up 51 cents. Ethanol futures down 9 hundredths at 142 2/10 of a cent, and heating oil about 3 cents higher on the day. Gasoline on the RBOB at $1.62 3/10, 0.8 of a cent higher, and natural gas down 4 cents at 2.29 9/10. The ethanol futures are rather down 8 points. The dollar down 0.263 for the day, and gold futures at $1,487.70. up $10.10. We're now joined by Jackie Vakes. She's with Total Farm Marketing by Stuart Peterson and hails from Hollister, Missouri. Hey, Jackie, thank you so much for being with us for the afternoon. Sure hope you've been having a great day, and I look forward to our discussion.
You're welcome. I love being here.
Well, support and resistance. I don't think they've changed much, but we probably should go through them again this week.
Yep. If you look at Dease corn, and this will be the last week I'm going to do Dease corn, 391, 361, and 313 are support, and resistance 415, 439, 473, and you're right, they didn't change from last week. Same way with March, $4 support, 395, 370, resistance 411, 425, 448. On soybeans, November, support 919, $9, 881. Resistance 942, 955, and 986. And on March, 914, 839, 780. Resistance 960, 997, and 1034. When I look at the bigger picture, Todd, you know, to be honest with you, I'm becoming more long-term bullish on corn and beans both. I've been bullish on beans for quite a while, but for right now on corn, I see $4 as a really strong resistance point, and I think if we could close above that, we might have a chance at 4 1/4, depending upon how things move along here. But on beans, I see $9 as support, pretty long-term support, with $10 as resistance, because you just look at the bigger picture, and you can see how much everything has changed from when we were at almost a billion bushels of carry out to where we are right now at 460 million.
What's the managed money done since last week? Anything?
Well, nothing in soft red wheat. 18,000 short last week, 18,000 short this week. Corn, they're getting shorter, 113,000 compared to 106,000. Beans, longer, 36,000 compared to 1,000 last week. When you look at soy meal, we're net short 31,000 compared to 43. So they're lightening up on their short positions in soy meal. And that's because soy meal shipments have been brisk. And when you look at soy oil, 37,000 short, excuse me, and 25,000 was where we were last week. And I said short, I meant long, actually. So on soy oil, we're long, 37,000 right now. So, you know, they're moving around, but very... I'd say it's almost like tiptoeing, because these are not great big moves compared to what they've done in the past at times.
What do you make of the cold weather over the weekend? Snow is a different problem, but it's cold weather, and that ended the growing season in Iowa, parts of Nebraska, probably a large part of Nebraska, Minnesota. And certainly the Dakotas.
Well, I updated my numbers for North and South Dakota according to where they were this week. You know, they were, corn was 42% mature in North Dakota and 53% mature in South Dakota. So that tells me we have 604 million bushels of potential light test weight corn, or corn that's not even going to be harvested at all. When you look at beans, they were 16% harvested on beans in North Dakota and 13% harvested on beans in South Dakota, which is very concerning. And that says we've got about 415.3 million bushels that are sitting out there. And, you know, we've heard from some of our clients that at this point in time, you know, they're under the snow. They just don't even know if they're going to do anything with them at all. And so pretty scary when you only have 460 million bushel carry out. But we won't have these numbers. You know, we won't really be able to confirm these numbers until we either get to the end of this year or possibly not again until next October.
Yeah, because they'll ship directly to the PNW. They certainly would have an impact on the ability of China to import soybeans from the United States, or possibly make them go to a different port, maybe New Orleans. What do we know?
The one thing we do know is that on this last round of export inspections, PNW is where China took beans. They didn't take it from any of the other ports in the United States that they have access to. And so I think that, you know, that in itself, you just summed it up pretty well. It makes a person really, really nervous. You know, at this point in time, China's taken 1.387 million metric tons of beans, which is 8.35%. They did export sales, or they've committed to that. That would be right on with what we shipped to them a year ago. So it's going to be interesting. And yet, you know, the year before we shipped 33 million tons. When you look at export inspections, wheat exports are running 21% ahead of a year ago. And USDA is forecasting a 1% increase. Corn is 64% behind a year ago, which isn't really a big surprise. I mean, we were really front-loading last year. So the USDA says that down 8% for the whole season. Soybeans 7% ahead of a year ago. And a week ago, they were 17% ahead. So, you know, that it slowed down a little, but the USDA is forecasting 2% increase on beans this year. So all of those things are, you know, are positive as we move along. You know, it's just everything takes time. That's the toughest part about this job is, you know, you can be so right on with what your thinking is, but the timing isn't necessarily going to be where it's supposed to be. You know, after we did Commodity Week this last week, Todd, I had some questions that people called and asked about why are the USDA numbers, why are they adjusting those corn numbers? You know, why is that happening? Why aren't we seeing the same type of things happening necessarily in as big an amount on beans? And the best answer I can give is, you know, corn's an issue. It's impossible to track feed usage. And so, you know, the only way you can do it is, you know, you make adjustments to the prior year's production after you see what the final grain stocks are on September 30th. And so then, you know, they use the numbers you can physically track, like export sales and those types of things. And then any difference is going to be adjusted in feed usage. And so I had one person say, well, I knew that it was going to be like that, and I was betting on that all the way through the whole thing. But unfortunately, you know, this is the way it is. You know, the long-term picture, you can have perfectly right, but be very wrong in the short term. When you look at beans, you know, they're much more straight away because we feed very few beans actually physically to cattle or anything else. And so that's a little bit easier situation, but I understand why people get frustrated. There's no question about that.
And as it happens, USDA in the last 24 hours sometimes has announced that it's considering doing with the corn grain stocks in the September or the final report what it does with the soybean stocks, because it really does have with the soybeans, it has an accounting and it adjusts the previous year's crop. It does not for corn. And they may start doing that in the fall of 2020. So we'll see. The announcement was just, we're thinking about it.
They're pretty good at that. I tell you what. I mean, I'm going to go to another meeting next week, and I think that you know, I know that they listen to what we say. I know that a lot of times their hands are tied for a period of time until they can figure out how to get around some of the requirements that there are. But You know, I think that it's they don't like to have mud thrown in their face either. And these types of things years ago didn't make nearly as much difference as they do today because of this world market that we're in.
Yeah, speaking of that, let's turn our attention to the competition. What do we know about Brazil and their planting season?
Well, they're still struggling with their planting. I mean, they're starting to make some progress, but again, just like last week, the non-irrigated guys are very concerned because they're just not getting the rains that that they were hoping for. And the best rains look not to come until the middle of November. So, you know, that's a scary, scary situation for them. I put together some information. You know, we had been talking about the fires down there. You know, they made such a big deal about the fires on the television. You know, they gave you the impression that the Amazon forest was on fire, you know, and everything else. And so I thought that everybody might be interested in what actually was going on down there, you know, because the world considers that to be the lungs of the earth. You know, we've done things, you and I have done things talking about how much oxygen comes out of the Amazon rainforest, how it actually creates a river above it because of the amount of moisture that comes up from the forest itself. But the big thing down there is when you have these fires going on, no matter where they are, it tends to reduce the amount of moisture that they actually, the amount of rainfall that they actually get in South America itself. So about 80% of the fires in that Amazon region were set by ranchers, and they were clearing dry pastures in preparation for the rainy season. Most of the other 20% were due to what they call slash and burn land clearing by subsistence farmers. The new administration has allowed these subsistence farmers to be able to plant and sell. They were always held back all these years. So now they're clearing some land, but very little of that land that's been cleared is going to be used for grain production. The majority is going to be used for beef production, basically. And most of that, again, is by the subsistence farmers. So right now, they've got about 63.99 million hectares of land, of crop land in Brazil, and that's about 7.6% of Brazil's total area. When you look at the forested areas, mostly in the Amazon region, they occupy 66.3% of Brazil's total land area. So I think it's extremely interesting that what was going on here, actually, they had less fires this year than they've had in the past 7 years. But it made the news, and I guess that's all that counts. And I think when you look at, you know, you asked me about Brazil and their planting, I think that's another reason that we're seeing China kind of coming to the table. But I think it's so interesting, you know, that China comes in here and says, well, you know, we haven't signed anything and we haven't done this. And are you surprised, Todd, that they're saying that? Because, you know, every time that they talk about settling this, what do bean prices do? They jump. And so I think that, you know, they're very, very smart people. I shouldn't say think. I know that they're very, very smart people. And they know how sensitive these markets are to anything that can come around. So it's going to be an interesting number of weeks as we move forward here and see what really happens.
Indeed it will. Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd. Have a good one.
You too. That is Jackie Vakes. She's with Total Farm Marketing by Stuart Peterson. We're now joined by Scott Irwin, agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus at the University of Illinois to discuss yesterday's release of the RVOs by US EPA as it relates to ethanol. Probably a couple of things we should talk about up front. What does RVO stand for?
Renewable Volume Obligation under the Renewable Fuel Standards, or RFS.
And so yesterday, farmers and ethanol proponents across the United States were hopeful that the Trump administration would stand in their corner. It appears that's not the case as it's related to the SREs, or small refinery exemptions.
Well, this one's a really complicated story, Todd. Certainly disappointment relative to the deal that the ag and biofuels side thought they had negotiated with the president a couple weeks ago. It seemed pretty straightforward. Here's the starting point, though, that can be confusing to people. There was never any question about the RVOs, the volumes for the mandates that were proposed for 2020. It's not a question of what the volume numbers are. They haven't changed from the first time the 2020 numbers were proposed, and they're exactly the same in this supplemental proposal that was released yesterday. That can be confusing to people, but the volumes are exactly the same. This is all about how to account for small refinery exemptions when you move from the step of the volumes to the percentage standards. Because the way the RFS mandates are enforced is not through literally volumes, gallons. It's enforced in the form of a percentage standard at the obligated party level. So in other words, let's say that the total RFS renewable RVO is 20 billion gallons. 20 billion gallons. You'd think that that's obvious. Well, the way that that's enforced, Todd, is that the EPA provides to obligated parties a percentage that they have to then apply to their production and imports of gasoline, petroleum, gasoline, and diesel. And it's exactly in that computation where all of this controversy lies.
Is the percentage a percentage of the 20 billion gallons or a percent of all of their production?
So here's the trick. The 20 billion gallons never changed.
Right.
We're arguing about what the base should be for computing, the denominator, for computing the percentage standards that individual, basically, refiners have to follow for 2020. And that base is supposed to be petroleum, gasoline, and diesel consumption minus exempted diesel and gasoline volumes under the SRE program. So here's a simple example. If it's 20 billion gallons and the total of gasoline and diesel use, ignoring these SREs for the moment, is 200 billion gallons. It's not far from that. So 20 divided by 200 billion gallons is 10%. So any refiner would know that I have to, at the end of 2020, turn in RINs, the RFS credits that demonstrate blending, equal to 10% of what my refinery produced. So that's what the percentages represent. What has been happening is that the EPA would say, okay, 20 billion gallons, gasoline and diesel use is 200 billion gallons, and the percentage standard is 10%. But now we're going to, after we issue that final rule, we're going to come back and retroactively remove roughly 20 billion gallons from that denominator. So the gallons that the 10% is applied to is 180, not 200.
It's pick and roll.
Well, it's a version of the, yeah, you're right. It's a version of that. So that's what you do. That's what's been going on. And so all of this is a battle to get EPA to account for those 20 billion gallons of gasoline and diesel use associated in my example when you originally compute the percentages. So in other words, in my little example, I'm going to have to pull up my calculator, but when you computed those percentage standards, which appear to be 10%, it should not be 20 divided by 200, which is 10%. it should be 20 divided by 180, which should be, I think, about 12% if I'm doing this roughly in my head, something like 11.5 or 12%. And that's what this is all about. And the deal that supposedly was negotiated through the White House was that you would compute, you would project the amount of the SREs for 2020 based on what had happened in the past. Seems kind of straightforward, right? Well, there's just no other way to put it. As I said in my tweets yesterday, it was pretty clever, but the EPA basically really pulled the fast one. What they said is, well, we're going to completely change our policy about SREs starting in 2020. So this is a complicated story. In the past, all of these SRE petitions have to go through the Department of Energy, or DOE, before the EPA rules on them. And in the past, the DOE has apparently recommended a bunch of partial waivers of under the hardship materials that are presented. We don't know if it's 50%, 25%, whatever. They're all done in secret. And the EPA said, basically, they said, so now for 2020, what we're going to do is we're going to say, A, we're going to start following the DOE. We think we're probably maybe kind of sort of going to follow the DOE recommendations about issuing partial exemptions in the future in 2020. But we're not really promising exactly that we're going to do that, but that we think that's what we're going to do. So that means that in accounting for the expected or projected SREs in 2020, we're going to go back and completely reinterpret or redo or resimulate the history of SREs. We're going to go back and say, no, now if we're going to change that policy, then we're going to go back and we're going to say, here's the history of SREs if we had followed DOE recommendations, which for 3 years we've been completely ignoring. And so that way they get a reallocation expected for 2020 that's about half of what biofuels groups thought they had done with the president. Now, I know that that's, to your listeners, a very complicated story, but that's really what has happened. And so they just, you know, they just did an amazing about face on this issue of partial waivers. And so in theory, if the EPA follows this new policy to the letter that they're laying out about partial SREs for 2020, if they really do that, then their method, it does have a logic to it. It will result in so-called full implementation of the proposed volumes in percentage terms. But that relies on the EPA doing a 100% about face on this partial waiver issue that they've had just the opposite policy on for the last 3 years. Maybe they will do it, maybe they don't. It certainly creates another whole level of uncertainty. That's one. And number two, the bigger issue is that we have a 4 billion gallon hole in the RFS mandates from 2016 to 2018, and probably adding at least a billion gallons to that hole for the 2019 SREs when they're awarded, that Ag and Biofuels thought will at least be offsetting in the future some of that hole. And now this is a really tricky way of saying, no way. You're not going to get any of that back.
And we're taking another half.
No, not exactly. No, if the EPA follows through for 2020, when, now see, this is the sneaky part of this. The 2020 SREs will not be awarded till 2021. So you're saying if in 2021, the pattern of awarding partial SREs is exactly the same pattern that DOE recommended from 2016 through 2018, which nobody has any idea how that worked because there's no data in the public domain at all. But if that pattern from 16 to 18 is maintained in 2020 SREs, then the percentage standards will enforce approximately full implementation of the roughly 20 billion gallons. It will work. But we will not have made a single gallon of progress in filling any of the hole from 2016 to 2019. Now, maybe we wouldn't have made, I've made a big deal, we wouldn't have, under the old system, maybe, you know, made that much progress, but we might have made some. Now we're not going to make any.
Thank you so much. It's always interesting.
I hope that was not too mind-bogglingly obtuse and archaic in terms of all the details, but that's what's really happening.
The RFS is in general.
Yeah, so I hope I didn't lose everybody.
Hey, thanks so much. Scott Irwin is an agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Let's check the weather forecast now with Drew Lerner. He's at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Hey, Drew, thanks so much for being with us. Looks like a little better forecast for the Corn Belt this week than it was last week when we were looking into the weekend. What do you see?
Yeah, it does look like that as we go forward through this next 2 weeks, we're probably going to only see a couple of frontal systems that will be active enough to prevent field progress from taking place. Of course, the biggest issue is how much moisture we've got on the ground and in the ground in some of those western and northwestern Corn Belt areas. And getting one more storm and keeping the temperatures cool is not what anybody wants. We do expect the next larger system to move across the western Corn Belt as we get out towards Sunday and Monday. And that system right now will probably produce 1.5 to 1.5 inches of rain, and that will keep the ground saturated or resaturated, as the case may be. And there may be a little bit of wet snow at the very tail end of that storm system. After it passes, we'll be dry and somewhat cooler again across the western Corn Belt. There'll be another frontal system that moves through the eastern belt. That'll come around maybe the middle to latter part of next week. It's a fairly wimpy event, but it will produce a few extra hundredths of an inch of moisture across some of the region. After that, we'll get into an even colder bias, looks like, as we go into the last days of October. And so it's going to be difficult to dry down some of these wetter areas in the west and north. It doesn't look like we're going to see any major storm systems that will produce heavy snowfall again like we saw last week, at least not in the near future. And that's the only good news, I suppose, I can provide for some of those folks that are still struggling with the snow field and the excess moisture.
Well, the weather has been bruising this year for all the growing regions across the United States. And I take it there's a tropical storm we have to watch out for, too.
Yeah, there's a tropical system that's beginning to evolve. The low-pressure center is right now very close to the Veracruz, Mexico coast. That would be like the equivalent of the southwesternmost corner of the Gulf of Mexico. And as we go forward through the night tonight and into the day tomorrow, that low-pressure system will move off the coast and over the warm waters in the western Gulf of Mexico, and that's when things will start stirring up a little bit. The system is going to move relatively quickly, but it will also have potential to become organized and maybe declared as a tropical or subtropical storm as it rushes across the heart of the Gulf and will reach the coast of the Florida Panhandle as we get out towards Friday evening. Landfall will occur Friday night going into Saturday morning. And if the storm has an opportunity to get well organized, we're going to see some very heavy rains occur in the southeastern corner of the U.S. They just had some halfway decent rainfall in the last 24 hours. Some 2 to 3 inch amounts of rain occurred in some of that cotton country in Georgia and Alabama and parts of Florida. And now we're going to be seeing a potential here for multiple inches more in some of that region. So the cotton quality of the late crop may start to deteriorate there, and obviously delays in peanut and soybean harvesting that still lingers.
And can you check on our neighbors in South America?
Yeah, Argentina continues to struggle with a lack of moisture in some of the western grain and oilseed producing areas. This is mostly a feature for minor wheat producing areas right now, and for some of the recently planted early corn and sunseed. Those crops all need moisture, and it's becoming more and more of a desperate situation as each day goes along. They've had some spits and spats here recently, but there hasn't been any general soaking, and I don't think that's going to change much for a while. Now, Buenos Aires is the nation's number one wheat-producing province, and the south part of Buenos Aires has been fairly dry for a while. They are going to get some rain over the next couple of days, and so that'll improve that crop quite a bit. In Brazil, of course, it's been a frustrating season so far for crop planting and emergence and establishment from Mato Grosso into Goiás and parts of Paraná and São Paulo. These areas are going to continue with a kind of a rough week ahead with just some sporadic showers, mostly net drying conditions. But next week, as we get into the middle to latter part of the week and into the following weekend, I think we'll see a much better distribution of rain. I do believe this will be the start of monsoonal rainfall. It'll be kind of erratic at first, but we should see good coverage and an improving trend in that planting process.
Hey, thanks so much.
Have a great day.
You too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for this Wednesday afternoon. Check us out online anytime you'd like at willag.org, by the way, willag.org. There we post all of our agricultural programming for you to get to and listen to on demand anytime you'd like. It's posted not long after it airs on our radio stations in mostly its entirety, and sometimes even before it airs on the stations. You can also find as a podcast in Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, on the Google One or Google Play Store, the NPR One app, and of course in iTunes. You have a great afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.